our debate takes place in the context of the United Nations Pact for the Future. The Pact for the Future is the most comprehensive international agreement in decades. The Pact reaffirms global commitment to the United Nations, the international system, and the principles of international law. And the question we are supposed to debate is, how can we implement an equitable, effective global governance in the today's context? I ask you, do you really think that it is possible? Do you really think that it will be possible to implement an inclusive, effective, and equitable governance in the frame of the international order, of the multilateral system we know today? I am sorry to be pessimistic, Mr. Chair. But fact is that the liberal order put in place after the Second World War is aggressed from all parts. We live in a world of global risk in which even the most powerful state cannot cope alone with pandemics, global warming, poverty, inequality, and conflicts. But the United Nations and the OSCE are outdated. The UN was created to protect the world from war, but today it seems powerless. Russia and the United States can veto any measure proposed by the Security Council. The UNRWA, the UN agency responsible for supporting Palestinian refugees, is under attack. And the UN Secretary General has been declared persona non grata in Israel. Multilateralism has run out of alternatives. The United Nations General Assembly has certainly increased the number of resolutions requiring only a majority of its members to pass. On September 18 last year, for example, it called for an end within 12 months to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. But symbolic decisions such as cease, which the General Assembly is not capable of translating into action, make the United Nations look even more like an important institution. Today, the tendency to isolate and return to regional alliances outweighs the ability to generate common solutions. The latter clashes with the desire to expand national economic space or appropriate goods available elsewhere. With the fragmentation of the global economy, tensions between the major powers are on the rise, and the law of the strongest prevails. Attempts to strengthen national capabilities through exclusion have never brought national security. On the contrary, they have usually been the first signs of international conflict. We just spoke about sustainable environment, respect of climate conventions, but we have to acknowledge that it is difficult to achieve, for example, the goals of the climate change if conflicts prevail all over the world. We just learned that there is a ceasefire in Gaza. At least we hope so. But until now, we just have no political solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Many countries criticize the West for lecturing them on human rights and international law over Ukraine, while being very cautious now that Israel is massively violating rights in Gaza and in the West Bank. The response to the war in Ukraine showed the world at what can be done when a state violates its international obligations. Every instrument was used to mobilize international protection, sanction Moscow, grant asylum to refugees, and support the investigations of international justice. And this contrasts with the ways the same countries responded to the war in Gaza. A great deal of silence and little condemnation. It's clear that Western states regard international standards as a menu à la carte. Ladies and gentlemen, it was a time when we thought Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, was the most dangerous person in the world for aggressing Ukraine, violating its sovereignty and international law. But today, we have to acknowledge that Vladimir Putin is far from being isolated. Violations of international law are multiplying. I mentioned Ukraine, the Middle East, but listen to the threatening speeches of the American elected president. He asserts his country's expansionist ambitions. At a press conference, he refused to rule out using the army to side the Panama Canal, but also Greenland, a semi-autonomous territory belonging to Denmark since 1721, and part of NATO. Trump's statements on Panama and Greenland raise serious concern. Let's speak only about Europe and the example of Europe. There are also commentators that identify Donald Trump as the biggest political threat to Europe's defense. If it is unlikely that any US president will fully disengage from Europe, Donald Trump might reduce the size of the American contingent. If Washington were to find itself hard-pressed elsewhere, it would need to redeploy its troops away from Europe. It would be up to the Europeans to compensate. A defense spending target for NATO countries of 5% compared with the current 2% of GDP. Donald Trump's 5% target seems unrealistic, and this trend would leave Europe gravely underarmed and underdefended. The continent is increasingly vulnerable in the event of a major conflict. Europe is unprepared for war with Russia, and large part of the continent might not even be willing to fight. Because Europe is divided, a pass to the east cannot be excluded for Austria, and is already not ruled out by countries like Hungary and Slovakia. This could signify a chaotic European policy regarding Russia. It even seems that dividing Europe is Donald Trump's and Elon Musk's preferred option, judging by the latter's efforts to support populist parties and movements such as Germany, AfD, or to criticize European governments that are guarantors of Ukraine, like Great Britain. A divided and weak Europe would thus be more dependent on the United States foreign and security policy. Ladies and gentlemen, under this condition, discussing the means of including effective and equitable global governance may be nice, but utopian. The international community has neither a strategy nor a plan for doing so. I'm sorry to be too pessimistic.